Angelina Rodriguez was anxious as she waited for her husband, Joe Urich, to come home. It was May 8th, 2015. Earlier that day, she and Joe, along with Charlie, their 10-month-old baby, had headed up to their lake house off Berlin Lake in Berlin Township in Ohio for the weekend. They had gone out on their boat in the afternoon and then came back to the lake house and enjoyed hot dogs on the grill. After Charlie was asleep for the night, they had argued over whether or not Joe would take the boat out to go meet up with some of his friends. Angelina, who was also 5 months pregnant, wanted Joe to stay in with her, but Joe wanted to go. She eventually gave in, as she would later testify, and so Joe left. But now it was almost midnight, and although Joe had called her at 11:30 to tell her that he was on his way back, he still wasn't home. She was worried. She didn't like him being out at night by himself, so she was watching intently for him to pull in. Finally, after what seemed like an eternity, she saw the lights on the boat coming into their dock area. She waited for him to come in. 5 minutes passed, then 10. She looked at her phone and it was now 12:05 a.m. What was he doing? She called him and then met him at the door. She immediately noticed that Joe was shaken up about something.
He comes up to the house and basically told me that he had hit something.
Okay. Did he tell you what he had hit?
No, I thought he hit the neighbor's dock or something was my initial thoughts pulling into the cove.
You said Joe was shaken up and he seemed upset?
Yeah, he seemed upset, anxious, and like I said, pretty shaken up.
Meanwhile, Richard Nolan from the Portage County Sheriff's Office was responding to a call of a collision on Berlin Lake. There was reportedly a two-boat crash with injuries. When he arrived at the lake, there were already numerous police and rescue personnel from multiple agencies there. There were a couple guys who were soaking wet, and so he offered them blankets. One man took one and the other didn't. He asked what happened and they told him that they had just pulled someone from the water and brought him to shore. There were two men who had been fishing when their boat was struck by another boat. The two men had already been transferred to the hospital, Nolan was told. Then, Nolan received a call from dispatch. They said they had a female caller on the line who said her husband had struck something on the water and she wanted to talk to someone about it. It was just after 1 a.m. when Angelina called 911. My husband hit a boat on his way home, she told the operator. At that point, neither Angelina nor Joe fully realized the severity of the situation. Not only had the boat Joe hit been occupied, but one of the occupants had already died from his injuries. And the other occupant had quite a story to tell about what he says really happened that night. Around the same time that Angelina Rodriguez was calling 911, 42-year-old Bruce Lindemood was being treated at Robinson Memorial Hospital. He had contusions and had severely injured his arm. While he was being treated, he learned that his friend of 22 years and fishing buddy that night, Neil Brian Cuppett, wasn't going to make it. What had started as a routine fishing trip on Bruce's fishing boat had ended in a nightmare. But when all is said and done, what would the penalty be for someone who caused such a tragedy? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 108. It would take nearly 4 months for charges to be brought in the case. In early September 2015, a grand jury in Mahoning County indicted 36-year-old Joe Urich, who was a prominent surgeon in the area. He was charged with aggravated vehicular homicide, aggravated vehicular assault, two counts of operating a vehicle while intoxicated, and failure to stop after an accident. According to investigators, Urich had been drinking before he smashed his Bayliner boat into the fishing boat. He then fled the scene as the boat's occupants, Bruce Lindemood and Neil Brian Cuppett, were thrown into the water. In July 2017, Joe Urich's trial began, but not before the judge in the case, Judge Jack Durkin, dealt a huge blow to the prosecution. At a pre-trial hearing, the defense argued that Joe Urich's blood alcohol levels should not be admissible because the samples were not refrigerated in time, as they were required to be under Ohio health regulations. According to reports, Joe's blood alcohol level was allegedly 0.152, almost double the legal limit. Prosecutors argued that even though the samples hadn't been refrigerated, it did not affect the accuracy of the results. Officers testified that they weren't even aware of the regulation that required them to be refrigerated. Now, this is important because this issue could come up as a possible appellate issue later, as Karen Kobel, an Ohio attorney I spoke to about this case, told me.
In all cases, any kind of evidence, whether it's blood, urine, a gun, whatever, the law enforcement has particular duties to handle that evidence in a way that doesn't taint it. And convictions are often thrown out where evidence has been mishandled. And when it comes to blood and urine, the Ohio Administrative Code is very particular with how that has to be handled. It can only be taken at certain times. It has to be refrigerated. When it's tested, it has to be mixed with a certain ratio of chemicals to do a particular test, right? And courts will overturn convictions based on blood and urine tests where the handling of that blood and urine didn't comply with the Ohio Administrative Code.
And as for those officers testifying that they didn't know about the regulations, Karen found that to be, well, shocking.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking. I mean, I think that usually that kind of evidence gathering is done by people who know what they're doing, right? Or if you don't know what you're doing, before you collect it or draw blood or urine, you're going to call someone who does know. So, but you see sometimes law enforcement mishandle other types of evidence. For example, there are procedures police have to go through when they impound a car and search it, right? With doing an inventory search. And sometimes that's messed up.
The judge agreed that the results were likely accurate. However, he sided with the defense and ruled them inadmissible. Further, he dismissed one of the charges of operating a vehicle under the influence, a charge which would have required lab numbers to prove his impairment. Joe Urich waived his right to a jury trial, and so Judge Jack Durkin would be presiding over the trial and determining his guilt or innocence. In her opening statements, prosecutor Dawn Cantalamessa told the judge that not only had Joe Urich been drinking, but that he was speeding down the lake and driving erratically when he crashed into the fishing boat, that he even yelled at the victims afterwards and then sped away without offering any assistance or sticking around to speak to police. "He's a doctor," she said. "He left that scene because he was intoxicated and he was looking out for himself." She pointed out that he didn't call the police after the accident. Rather, it was his wife who called, an hour and a half afterwards. She said the fishing boat was stationary when the crash occurred and that its lights were on. She said the evidence the judge would hear over the next few days would be evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that Joe Urich committed the crimes for which he is charged. That night, the defendant decided to operate that watercraft while under the influence of alcohol, she told the judge, and he took the life of a husband, father, and friend. He also caused serious physical injury to the surviving victim. She asked for him to find Joe Urich guilty. In his opening statements, Joe's attorney said he was not impaired and he was not reckless. He called what happened that night a terrible accident that ended Neil Brian Cuppett's life and changed everyone else's life who was involved. He said no one meant for this to happen and that it was the perfect storm, a dark night, poor lighting, location, and a little too much speed. He said Joe and his wife are both physicians, and that as a surgeon, Joe had enlisted in the Army and at three times put himself in harm's way to help others. He admitted that Joe had a couple drinks that night, but said witnesses will testify that they did not see any signs of impairment. He said within minutes of Joe leaving his friends at the campground that night, a violent collision occurred. Not only were Bruce Lindemood and Neil Brian Cuppett thrown out of the fishing boat, but Joe was also thrown around inside his boat and sustained injuries. It was a collision that happened out of the blue, he told the judge, and Joe didn't know what had happened. He didn't see or hear anything prior to or after the collision, and so he decided to take off before his own boat sank. He said when Joe got home, he started to put two and two together. He had called his friend Andrew, who said he was responding to a distress call on the lake, and he knew he had just hit something. He began to fear that what he had hit wasn't a rock, and that's when they called the police. He said at the end, the prosecution will not be able to prove that Joe was impaired or that he was reckless. Rather, this was a tragic accident, and Joe should be found not guilty. The state's first witness was Jenny Marie Cuppett, Neil Brian Cuppett's wife. She said she had been married to him, whom she called Brian, for 23 years. They had one son together, who is now 18. She told the judge that Brian was a senior maintenance mechanic for a windows company, as well as a coach for their son's every sport throughout the years. On Friday, May 8th, 2018, Brian came home from work, they ate dinner together, and then he went fishing with his friend Bruce, something he did often. He told her that he would be late that night because they were getting a late start. She hung out with their son and then went to bed. It was just another normal night, she said, until she got a call in the middle of the night from the hospital. They told her that her husband had been in an accident. When she got to the hospital, she was escorted to a private room where she was then given the news that her husband was dead. Bruce Lindemood was the state's next witness. He testified that he and Brian Cuppett had been friends for about 20 years and that they went fishing and hunting together often. They would talk every other day, if not daily. On May 8th, 2015, he said he and Brian went fishing at Berlin Lake around 8 p.m. The water was calm, like glass, he said, and the sky was clear. A perfect night for fishing. He testified that his fishing boat had a trolling motor in the front that propels the boat slowly. The boat itself was made in 1990, and he had had it for about 5 or 6 years. The prosecutor asked him if he had lights on in his boat, and he said yes. He had navigation lights, green on the front and white on the rear, as well as an electric battery-operated lantern he had towards the back of the boat. All lights were working, he said. He was seated in the right rear seat, and Brian was seated in the front seat. It was extremely quiet, but he could hear other fishermen. A few hours after they had started fishing, he heard Brian say, "What is this guy doing?" They were facing in opposite directions at the time. After Brian said that, he turned around and it wasn't but a second or two when he saw a bright light. The next thing he knew, he was falling backwards into the water. They were about 100 yards away from the bridge.
I remember spinning underwater and finding my way to the surface. And when it's dark and you're underwater, spinning around, that you become very disoriented to which way is up, which sounds kind of funny, but that's just how it is. And I remember it being a struggle to get to the surface.
He said he remembers being under the water when something smashed into his arm. As soon as he got to the surface, there was a bright light in his face, and someone was screaming and cussing at him.
And what was that person saying to you?
He was saying, "What the fuck are you doing out here?"
Did you say anything back to him?
Help.
Okay. Did he say anything else?
Well, he said that multiple times.
Okay.
And then, that was it.
He said the man then floored it and sped away under the bridge.
Did he offer any assistance?
None whatsoever.
Did he throw you any kind of life jacket or life preserver?
No.
Did he inform you that he was going to go get help?
No.
He doesn't know how, but somehow he was able to pull himself back up onto his boat. He thought he was going to drown. He saw that his boat was heavily damaged. The side of his boat was completely crushed. He noticed that Brian wasn't on the boat, and so he started screaming for him immediately. He continued to yell for help, and finally someone came. Another boat showed up, and he yelled out that he couldn't find his friend. The boat circled around him, and someone on that boat jumped in the lake and found Brian. They struggled to pull him up out of the water. Bruce told the court that Brian is a big guy, and so they ended up just hanging onto the boat and motoring over to shore. A second boat then came out to help him and tied their boat to his and took him onto shore. An ambulance was already there when they pulled up. He saw one of the EMTs working on Brian. The prosecutor asked what was going on with him at the time. Bruce said he thought his arm was broken in many spots. He was asked if they had snacks and alcohol while they had been fishing, and he said they had snacks, but no alcohol. Bruce testified that he went to the hospital and he had contusions. There was also meat missing from his arm, and he had to go to physical therapy to get it to work properly again. He said he found out that evening while at the hospital that Brian didn't make it. On cross-examination, Bruce testified that he put his lantern on as soon as it got dark and that they were not anchored when the crash occurred. When asked if he was supposed to be anchored while on the channel, he said no. He also said he had the proper navigation lights on. Dustin Cease testified that he was on the first boat that pulled up to help Bruce and Brian. He said he and some friends were driving in their boat after doing some fishing when he saw a Bayliner boat speeding by. He said he told his friend, "You know, that guy's going to kill somebody." Minutes later, he saw people fishing offshore, and they shouted to him that there had been a crash. He drove over to the crash scene and saw a man in the water. He asked the man what happened, and the man said, "A big fucking boat just blew us out of the water, and I can't find my friend." Dustin testified that he jumped into the water and pulled him out. After everybody had gotten to shore, Dustin said he asked Bruce again what had happened. He testified that Bruce told him that after the guy hit him, the guy then cussed him out and said, "What the fuck are you guys doing out here?" Another witness, Jennifer Kingsley, told the court that she was fishing on Berlin Lake that night with her boyfriend, Michael, her son, and her niece. She testified that there were both fishing boats and speedboats on the lake. She said she heard what sounded like a party to her right across the lake prior to hearing the crash.
I remember just hearing a lot of music and hooping and hollering. Okay. And then a speedboat coming really fast across the lake.
Okay.
And then you just heard this really big boom. And then there was some arguing about lights on the boat. And then a man yelling for his friend and for help.
She said the speedboat came from the direction of where she heard the party. As for the argument, she heard one guy yell, "What are you doing? You don't have any lights on your boat. Where are your lights?" She said she doesn't know who said that. She then heard the speedboat again, speeding away under the bridge, while at the same time, she could hear the man on the fishing boat screaming for help for his friend Brian. She said they weren't able to go help. After they got back to shore, she went over to the bridge where the ambulance and police were. She was asked if the fishing boat had lights on, and she said yes, it did. The state called more witnesses to the stand who had either seen or heard something that night on the lake. Simon Paul Four said he and his girlfriend and her son were fishing on shore when they heard a loud bang. Then he heard a man yell, "You hit us." He took his flashlight out and shined it over to where the noise was coming from. He could hear the man on the fishing boat yelling that his buddy was in the water and needed help. He then heard another voice yell, "Throw him a life jacket." And then the bigger boat sped away under the bridge into a no-wake zone, but definitely creating a wake. He testified that he saw both boats prior to the accident. He knows for sure that the fishing boat had a light on the bow, but couldn't recall if there was one on the back. He said he saw the boat that left the scene, the Bayliner with a maroon stripe on it, cruising up and down the lake, playing music very loud. He testified that he also saw them raise koozies. He said they were in no position to help since they were fishing on shore, and so he called 911. His girlfriend was going to swim over there, but he told her the water was too cold and it was too far. So instead, his girlfriend used his flashlight to flag down another boat to help. She then directed them to the crash. His girlfriend, Constantina Covert, also took the stand. She described seeing the Bayliner boat earlier in the night.
One particular we recollected that stuck to my mind because of the music that was playing, and it was so loud, and multiple passengers on the boat. It had gone past us many times while we were there all evening, during evening time and through the night.
Could you describe that boat?
It was maroon and white.
Okay.
And it was a speedboat, like similar to, like you could ski behind or boat tube behind. You could do many different things.
Bigger than a fishing boat?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
She said they stayed and fished there for hours. They were getting ready to leave. She was walking up to her Jeep, and her son and Simon were starting up the hill when they heard a big noise. She asked what that was, and her son said it sounded like the motor blew on that boat.
And the next thing, and you could see the lights on both boats. Next thing you know, we heard a conversation of a gentleman hollering.
The objection was sustained. She described what she heard after the crash.
The gentleman hollered, "You hit us. My buddy's in the water." And the other gentleman stated, "Throw him a life jacket." And next thing, I was still on top of the bridge. He was going extremely fast, more than he should have been through a wake zone.
And how?
That is buoys there that are marked a wake zone. And at this time, I was standing at the top of the bridge. I followed this boat from the north side of the bridge, ran across the road to the south side of the bridge, and watched where he went.
Okay.
At that time, that I assumed, because that's when his light, he turned the light out on his boat.
She said he never slowed down, just sped away and turned off his light after yelling, "Throw him a life jacket." She said she could hear the man on the fishing boat yelling for help and saying his buddy was in the water. She said she was reporting everything she was seeing to the 911 operator. Another boat then came in from the south. She hollered at the people on the boat that there was an accident, and she directed them to where. Constantina's son testified too. He, too, said that after the crash, he could hear people screaming at each other. According to him, one guy said, "Help, my friend is in the water. Can you help him?" The other guy said, "Throw him a life jacket." He then heard, "You didn't have your lights on." And then, "Yeah, I did." He recalled hearing a boat engine rev up and then saw the Bayliner pass him. When asked if it was going fast, he said yes, like a speedboat. Meanwhile, he could hear the guy in the fishing boat yelling for help. Andrew Krogan was a friend of Joe Urich's. He testified that on May 8, 2015, he put his boat in the water at Berlin Lake and docked to a campground. He was with his friend Ben and Ben's girlfriend. Earlier in the night, he said they ran into Joe and Angelina, who were out on their boat with their baby. They all hung out at the beach. He testified that they all went home for a bit, but later, Joe decided to meet up with them and go out. He, Ben, and Ben's girlfriend waited on Joe, and he guessed that he probably had a beer or two while waiting for him. Once Joe arrived back at the campground, they went to a place called Ben's Restaurant and sat at the bar. He said he doesn't recall if he ate, but he had two beers and a shot. He said he believes Joe had the same, two beers and a shot. The prosecutor asked him about giving a statement to police. He said the following week after the accident, he was called into the police station. She pointed out that he told them that they had 2 to 3 beers and 1 to 2 shots. He said he doesn't recall that, that he's pretty certain it was just 2 beers and 1 shot. She then played his video statement for him, and he agreed that his memory was probably better back then. Andrew had also told police that when Joe arrived at the campground, they probably spent about 15 minutes there before heading out to the restaurant. He said he couldn't recall that now. After leaving the restaurant, he testified that they went through a drive-thru and then went back to the campground. They then went down to the docks, turned the radio on in the boat, and hung out there. Andrew, Joe, Ben, Ben's girlfriend, and another few friends joined in with their boat. He said he drank alcohol there, but he can't say for certain if Joe did. They were there for another hour or hour and a half before Joe left in his boat. He doesn't recall Joe saying goodbye, but he's sure he did. He assumed Joe was going home. A few minutes later, he said a neighbor came by.
We were still down at the docks and the music was playing fairly loud. A neighbor came down and said, "We heard an explosion. Lower your music. We hear somebody yelling for help." At which point we lowered my music and then we could hear somebody yelling for help. And that's when we decided, let's go see what's going on and go help, and jumped in the boats.
He said he jumped in his boat with another friend, and his friend Adam jumped in his boat. He said he was looking for flames since the neighbor had called it an explosion. Then his phone rang. It was Joe.
And what did he say?
He said that he believed he hit something and that it wasn't good.
Okay. That he hit something. He didn't say what it was and that it wasn't good. Is that what he said?
Yes.
He said they pulled up to the scene where the fishing boat was and he could see a person in the water. There was also another fishing boat out there too, trying to help. He was asked whether he saw if they had any lights on, and he said he didn't notice. His friend Adam and a couple others jumped in the water. Adam had the man in the back of his boat by the time he even pulled up. His two friends who had jumped in the water then went in Adam's boat with the other man to the shore. He testified that he didn't go. He went back to his campground with another friend, Nick. He said they were pretty quiet and they were both pretty upset. He said he recalled someone walking by and asking what was going on. He said he told him it wasn't good and then kept walking. He then received another phone call, this one from Joe's wife, Angelina. He said they then went over to Joe's house because Angelina had said she was worried about Joe. Nick's girlfriend drove them to Joe's house. They met Joe and Angelina outside. He said he doesn't remember what was said. He thinks he just gave Joe a hug and told him, "I love you, buddy," and then they left.
What was his demeanor when you saw him?
Pale, scared, I guess.
Scared? You said pale. You could see just, that at
just,
night?
Well, I guess that just like that ghostly look, you know, just worried, I guess.
The prosecutor asked if Joe had a beer that night before he left the dock, and he said he doesn't know. He wasn't paying attention to what he was doing. She then pointed out that he told police something different. He said then that he thinks Joe had a beer. He testified that he doesn't know for sure if he did or not. On cross-examination, he said Joe was visibly upset when they went over to his house. He said Angelina told him that she had called the police, so he gave him a hug and left. He was asked if he noticed Joe slurring his speech at all, and he said no. Since prosecutors couldn't point to Joe's blood alcohol level to show that he was impaired, they introduced surveillance video from Ben's restaurant, where Joe and his friends had gone that night. Rachel Mace, a bartender at the restaurant, testified as the video played. In the video, Joe and three others could be seen entering and sitting at the bar at 9:47 p.m. Rachel said she knew Andrew, but had met Joe just that night. She was one of two bartenders waiting on the group, and she remembers talking to Joe about family stuff. She discovered that she knew his wife, Angelina. She testified that she believes they each drank two beers and then had what's called a little beer, which she said is a shot meant to look like a beer. The group also ordered appetizers, but she didn't pay attention to who was eating what. She said they left around 10:50. When she left work later that night, she remembered seeing fire trucks and ambulances. Lieutenant Greg Johnson with the Portage County Sheriff's Office testified that he interviewed Joe at his lake house after Angelina called 911. He got to the home at 1:48 a.m. Joe and Angelina were standing outside. They then went inside to the family room area. Lieutenant Johnson said he thanked Angelina for making the call, and then he asked Joe to tell him what happened.
Stated that he did not see any lights, wasn't sure what he hit, said he's familiar with the route back from Ben's restaurant back to his house on the cottage on Hawthorne. He did make the comment that he thought the water was a little lower during the time I was with him during the initial contact. We spoke about how fast did he think he was going. He stated that he was going 25 miles an hour or maybe under 25 miles an hour. Stated the boat was capable of doing 40 miles an hour. He acknowledged that he had his lights on, had his running lights on, and also his front-facing lights on.
Did he ever mention stopping after and talking with anyone right after he hit something?
No, he always maintained that he thought he hit a rock, but he maintained that he kept going.
He said Joe told him that he had been at Ben's restaurant for about an hour. He then said he docked his boat and went to his friend's house.
Did he mention having anything else to drink besides beer?
I specifically asked him that, and he maintained that he had only had beer.
Did he talk about hearing anything after the crash?
I did ask him if he had heard anything, and he said he maintained that he had heard nothing, that he had hit what he thought was a rock and that he had continued to keep going.
Lieutenant Johnson asked Joe if he could look at his boat, and they walked down to where the boat was docked together. He described Joe's maroon and white boat and said there was substantial damage on the left front side, including a hole in the boat. He took photos of it, which were shown to the court.
Did you ever ask the defendant if he had any injuries or if he fell during this crash?
Initially, I asked him if he had suffered any injuries. Later, as the investigation went on, I noticed that he had some abrasions on the left side of his neck.
Okay.
I asked him if they were related to the crash, if he had fallen down as a result of the crash. He wasn't even aware that he had any of those abrasions and said he couldn't recall if he had fallen down or not.
He couldn't recall. He didn't say whether or not he felt fallen off his chair or anything on his boat.
No, he said he couldn't recall how he got those marks on him, and he said he couldn't recall if he had fallen or not from the crash.
Lieutenant Johnson said he asked Joe about what alcohol he drank that night, and that Joe told him that they would find alcohol in his blood. During the course of the investigation, Lieutenant Johnson went to the hospital and spoke with Bruce Lindemood. It was there where he learned that Joe had actually said something to Bruce after the crash. He then went back to Joe's house, armed with this new information.
I had concerns with what I had been told previously by Mr. Urich based on this new information. I specifically asked him that, you know, based on this information, I believe that he knew he had hit a boat, and he maintained that he still thought he hit a rock. And I said, well, I am gained information that you actually had said something to the person that was in the water, told him what I was, my understanding of what had been said to him. And he immediately said that, no, he didn't say that. And then he went on to state that if he did say something, he now didn't recall saying that. Throughout the interview, he maintained that whatever, after he hit what he thought was a rock, he kept going.
Lieutenant Johnson said when he told Joe that the person in the other boat had died, Joe became very emotional.
Did you see any signs of intoxication?
Obvious signs of intoxication, as in someone not being able to walk. No, he was able to walk, and he was able to talk clearly.
Did you smell an odor of alcohol on him?
I did not detect that, but I always like to preface it. I have extremely bad sinus problems, so I'm not the greatest one to ask that question, but I did not detect any.
And you had already heard from the defendant that he admitted about drinking beers that night, correct?
Right from the beginning of my first contact, he acknowledged that he'd been consuming beer.
David Ford, with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, testified about the contributing factors in the collision that they and the Coast Guard had found.
First one I have is alcohol impairment. Second one is excessive speed. Third one is careless, reckless operation. Fourth one is rules of the road infractions. Fifth one is improper lookout. And number six is operator inattention. And those are all for vessel one, which the way this report is laid out refers to the Bayliner operated by Mr. Urich.
One of the last witnesses for the state was Dorothy Dean, the deputy coroner who conducted Brian's autopsy. She said he died from blunt force trauma to his head and neck. As photos of Brian's body were shown in court, Joe appeared to become emotional at the defense table. Dean testified that there were no drugs or alcohol found in Brian's system. When it came time for the defense to present their case, they began by calling an accident investigator to the stand, a man named Miles Beam. Beam told the court that there was no way of knowing for sure how fast Joe's boat had been going at the time of the crash. He also said that the lantern on Bruce and Brian's boat may have actually contributed to the crash, saying that instead of lighting up the boat, it could have done the opposite. He explained that it could have looked like lights on the shore, streetlights, or dock lighting. Joe's wife, Angelina Rodriguez, also took the stand for the defense. She testified that she's a family physician and that Joe is a general surgeon. Together, they have five kids, two from his previous marriage, and she and Joe now have three. She testified that on the night of the crash, Joe left her and Charlie to go meet up with his friend Andrew and his friends. After she argued with him about it, she eventually gave in and told him it was okay. She told the court that he works hard and doesn't go out with his friends often. Later that night, they were texting back and forth. She said she was pressuring him to come back. At about 11:30, Joe called her and told her he would be leaving soon and would be home very shortly. When Joe finally came inside the house, he told her that he had hit something with his boat. Angelina said she started questioning him about what he thought he had hit, but he told her he couldn't remember. She was asked if he was slurring his words, and she said no. She was asked if she smelled alcohol on him, and she said no.
Was he in any way unable to walk or maintain his balance or anything like that?
No.
Other than being upset, was he unable to communicate with you effectively?
No.
How would you describe his speech?
Normal.
Was it clear and coherent?
Yes.
How about his eyes? Did you notice anything about his eyes, if they were unusual in any way?
No, sir.
She said she tried to ask him questions about what he remembered. She was trying to find out exactly what he hit, but he wasn't able to tell her. She said she didn't call police then because she thought it was important to figure out what had happened first. According to Angelina's testimony, she and Joe made numerous other phone calls to their friends that night, their friends whom Joe had just left, to see if they had any idea what had happened. Joe had already talked to Andrew, who had mentioned tending to a distress call. Their friend Sherry also knew about that distress call.
I knew that there was this talk about a distress call. So they both basically just divulged to me that the distress call involved a boat and there was an ambulance on site.
Okay. So are you beginning to sort of put two and two together that maybe that this was that what Joe hit was tied to this?
Yes.
Has he still been able to tell you what he hit?
No. Actually, I was afraid to tell him because he was so emotionally distressed and I was there by myself with him.
All right.
I spent a couple minutes kind of explaining that to Sherry on the phone before we ended our conversation.
After hanging up with Sherry, she told Joe that he had hit another boat, and so they immediately called 911. She was asked again about Joe's speech, eyes, and ability to walk and move around. She said it was all completely normal. She said Sherry sent their friends Andrew, Nick, and Nick's girlfriend over to their house. They just came by briefly, and then the police came. She was asked about Joe's demeanor during this time.
At this point, it's clear that there was a boat that he had collided with. So he was very emotionally distressed, panicking in a sense.
She was asked to recall when Joe learned that there was a fatality. She broke down on the stand, apologizing and asking for a tissue. "I'm sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful," she said.
There was a point in time where Lieutenant Johnson comes back into the house and tells Joe basically that there was a fatality. And at that point, clearly, Joe became severely psychologically distressed.
She said the police asked if they could take the boat, and they agreed. Next up to the stand, following his wife's testimony, was Joe Urich. He told the court that he's a general surgeon who enlisted in the military and was deployed 3 times to combat zones. He said their bases would frequently get hit with rockets and indirect fire. One of those places was in Tikrit. He said his unit was responsible for providing medical support, but that they would also venture into various towns and spend time with local authorities to see if they could get government aid for their hospitals and local care. They would then go back to the combat zones. He described one incident where an explosion went off.
I was standing outside walking back from the latrine and heard a whistle, a loud impact, and it was an explosion.
How close to you was the explosion?
It was probably about 100 yards, maybe less. I don't remember. I was knocked to the ground. I remember being scared. Sorry.
It's okay. Do you need
a glass of
water?
No, I'm fine. I don't like to talk about it. And immediately, you know, things tend to go slow. You don't hear anything. You don't know what's going on. You just react. And what we had been told to do in that scenario in pre-deployment training is to grab your gear and get to your duty stations. I ended up operating that night on a significant number of our female nurses who had been injured.
Was it more than one blast that happened?
That was the first blast that I had experienced in 2009, but through my deployments, I had experienced others.
Any that close?
No.
First instance?
According to Joe's attorney, Joe had since been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. On the night of the boating accident, Joe testified that he ate dinner with his family, hot dogs on the grill. He recalled eating 3 hot dogs, possibly more. He said he usually eats around 6. Later, when he got to his friend Andrew's place, they immediately got in the car and went to the restaurant. He was asked if he remembers being at the restaurant, and he said yes. He remembers having 2 beers and 2 mini beers, which he said is an ounce of liqueur 43 topped with heavy cream to have the appearance of a beer. It's less alcohol than a whiskey shot, he said. He said he felt fine when they left. He didn't feel any different than any other part of the day. He didn't feel like he drank too much. They went through a drive-thru and then went back to the campground. He said he was there for about 45 minutes to an hour. He said he started a beer there, but didn't finish it. After talking to Angelina at 11:30, he pulled out of the dock to go home.
I cleared their docks. I looked around. I didn't see any lights. It was dark. In particular, I was looking for boating lights. I didn't observe any other traffic on that side of the lake. And I wanted to get home to Angelina, so I accelerated.
Did you know the nighttime speed limit?
Yes.
Did you observe the nighttime speed limit?
No, I was going faster than 10 miles an hour.
He doesn't know how fast he was traveling, but said around 20 miles per hour. He said he doesn't remember hearing anything on the lake other than an explosion. He acknowledged leaving right after, but he maintained that he did not remember saying anything to anyone afterwards, as he told Lieutenant Johnson.
I don't remember saying anything. If I did, I would not have said those things that he said under normal circumstances. When I heard that explosion, it triggered some memories for me. I don't remember anything else from the accident until I was over near the state park on the south side of the lake.
And when you said it triggered some memories for you, when you heard the explosion, what exactly happened?
The explosion.
Overruled.
The explosion sounded similar to what I experienced in Iraq. The explosion reminded me of the indirect fire.
He said he remembers being scared and not sure what the explosion was. He was afraid his boat was compromised, and so he tried to get back to his dock as quickly as he could. He testified that he called his friend Andrew when he got back to his dock because he wanted to see if they heard the explosion he heard and to see if they could help him figure out what happened. All he remembers from his conversation with Andrew was that Andrew said he was on a distress call and couldn't talk, which made him nervous. He said he didn't know why he would be responding to a distress call. He told Angelina that he had heard an explosion and didn't know what happened. He also told her about his conversation with Andrew about the distress call. They then started calling other people, and eventually they confirmed that he had likely hit a boat. They decided to call 911, and Angelina told him that everything was going to be okay. They just have to tell the truth. On cross-examination, the prosecutor pointed out to Joe that due to his deployment in the military, he knew the importance of treating injuries immediately, and he said yes. She also brought up his drinking that night and asked if, as a physician, he knows that alcohol can cause memory loss. He said yes.
So you already said you don't recall saying anything, is that right?
I don't remember saying anything, no.
And you've already said that you agree that you didn't remember saying something, but you told Lieutenant Johnson if you did say something, you didn't think it was that. Isn't that right, Judge?
Under normal circumstances, I wouldn't say that.
But you had been drinking that night, right?
Yes.
Okay. So it wasn't a normal circumstance, was it?
Overruled.
I don't understand the question.
You said under normal circumstances, you wouldn't have said something like that. But that night, you had been drinking. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
You had two beers and two shots at the bar, and then you started another beer at the campground, according to your testimony. Is that right?
Yes.
So in the hour, 45 minutes to an hour that you were at the campground, you only started a beer. Is that right?
Yes.
And what kind of beer was that?
I don't recall.
She told him that an empty beer can was found in his boat, and she asked him if that was from that night as well. He said no. She pointed out that although he testified that he heard an explosion, he didn't tell Lieutenant Johnson that. Instead, he told him he thought he hit a rock. Further, she said he never told Angelina that he thought he had hit a rock. He acknowledged that was true.
Now it's going back to when you're back at your house. At the point that Angelina calls 911, you know you've hit a boat at that point, is that right?
Yes.
Do you ever tell Lieutenant Johnson when he's there that you hit a boat?
No, because I didn't know I hit a boat prior to us calling the police.
You just said that you knew you hit a boat prior to calling 911.
We had just found out and immediately called 911.
Okay, and how long did it take Lieutenant Johnson to get there?
Within minutes.
Okay, so by the time he got there, you knew you hit a boat, right?
Objection.
Overruled.
Yes.
Do you ever tell Lieutenant Johnson that you hit a boat that night?
No.
After Joe's testimony, the defense then rested their case. And now it would be up to the judge to decide. Was Joe guilty of the charges against him? And if so, what should be the penalty? Judge Durkin began his verdict announcement by saying that if justice could be accomplished here, it would mean that they could simply turn back the hands of time. But that obviously, that's not something anyone can do. He told the court that he found Joe Urich not guilty of the more serious charges, the felonies, aggravated vehicular assault, and operating a watercraft while impaired. However, he found that he was guilty of vehicular homicide and leaving the scene of an accident, both misdemeanors. At his sentencing hearing a week later, prosecutors asked the judge to sentence Joe to 360 days in jail, $2,000 in fines, a five-year license suspension, and mandatory remedial boating courses. They also brought Brian Cuppett's wife up to the stand.
For the past 2 years, I have lived with a lot of pain, sorrow, and anger. Now I get the opportunity to vent and release all of these ugly emotions. In doing so, I hope to start the healing process for my family and I, to obtain some peace in my life and hopefully eventually find forgiveness. I cannot carry this bitterness inside of me for the rest of my life. The court will not permit me to say what I would like to express to Joe Urich, his wife, and their attorneys. Words like perjury, deceit, and coward first come to mind. Since this accident, I have had occasion to hear that Joe is an arrogant man who drinks too much. And as far as his attorneys go, they used every trick in the book to guarantee that a guilty man would be set free. They deliberately delayed the case for 2 years so that the witnesses would forget. They had the BAC declared inadmissible, and they advised Joe to eliminate a jury. I feel as if the defendant was the only one who had any rights in this case, as my husband certainly did not. I find the judicial system simply appalling. I do not know how these people sleep at night. One day they will all be held accountable in front of the Judge Almighty.
She said she met her husband when she was just 14 years old. She called him a good family man with morals and values.
He was an easygoing, friendly man who never met a stranger. He would have never drank alcohol while operating a boat and would have never left two injured men in the water. Joe Urich will never measure up to the man my husband was. He simply does not have the character.
She said her family is now broken and will never be whole again. She hopes Brian's death haunts Joe for the rest of his life. He killed another human being, left him for dead, and then lied about it, she said. This verdict was infuriating because justice was not served for my husband. Joe Urich also spoke to the court.
I accept full responsibility for the events in the accident on May 8, 2015. I respect the court's decisions and judgments in all these matters. I understand that my activities and my actions have negatively impacted multiple families. I'm truly sorry. Not a day goes by where I don't feel remorse or sympathy for the families involved. I think about Mr. Cuppett. I think about the descriptions of him being a father, a husband, a friend, the kind of person that I aspire to be. I know his loss has been a huge impact to his family. I think about Mr. Lindemann. I think about how his life has changed forever that night. Despite his feelings during the trial, he was able to show compassion towards my wife with kind words and gestures. Those things don't go unnoticed, and that is a true attribute to his character. I will never forget the consequences of my actions or forgive myself for the pain that I've caused these good people. I only hope to continue to serve my family, my community, and my country.
The defense told the judge that under Ohio law, he must consider Joe's military background and PTSD diagnosis when sentencing him. The law the defense was referring to was enacted in 2013. The law states, quote, "The sentencing court shall consider the offender's military service record and whether the offender has an emotional, mental, or physical condition that is traceable to the offender's service in the armed forces of the United States, and that was a contributing factor in the offender's commission of the offense or offenses." Karen Koble explains more.
Judges, with this new law, it was created in 2013 and it just added on to revised code 292914, as with all the other things that judges are required to consider in sentencing. They just added a requirement that judges consider military service. That's all that it says, right? A judge shall consider military service. It doesn't say what weight to assign that. It doesn't say whether to be more lenient. It doesn't say that you can't give a maximum or that it should be considered a mitigating factor. So all a judge has to do is consider it.
Generally speaking, the maximum in Ohio for vehicular homicide would be 6 months in jail and the loss of your license for 1 to 5 years. The maximum for leaving the scene would typically be 6 months in jail, a fine, and a loss of license for a minimum of 6 months. Instead of that, Judge Durkin sentenced Joe to a total of 12 months in prison and then suspended all but 10 days, meaning Joe would have to serve 10 days in prison, but then he would be released and placed on probation. If he violated that probation, he would then have to serve out the rest of his sentence. So after serving 10 days in prison, Joe was then put on house arrest for 90 days with electronic monitoring, was ordered to be on probation for 5 years, and had to perform 200 hours of community service. He was also ordered to take a mandatory course to keep his voting license. There seemed to be mixed reactions to both the verdict and the sentencing. Many, including Brian's wife, who told the court that she didn't feel justice had been served, seemed to feel that the sentence was not enough, considering that someone had lost their life in this case. That was one of the things I wanted to talk to Karen Koble about. She said the fact that Joe was convicted of the misdemeanors and not the felonies likely made the difference.
The statutory sentencing laws encourage trial judges to be a tad more lenient. So, for example, for lower level felonies, community control is often an option instead of prison. For a higher level felony, it's not usually an option for the types of offenders who commit higher level felony offenses. But for misdemeanors, you get that same level of consideration, right? This is a misdemeanor. We're not going to put you in prison for the maximum amount of time because it's a misdemeanor and we have lots of available community-based resources to put you on probation and supervision. Misdemeanor sentences are usually lighter. It's a rare misdemeanor case where someone gets a maximum sentence, and that's usually only because one of two things perhaps happened. One, the person has a history of criminal conduct such that the commission of this particular misdemeanor was just particularly egregious. Or the second thing is you get a max misdemeanor sentence because it was originally charged as a felony, but for whatever reason, like a plea bargain, they've said, okay, we'll agree that you don't have to have this felony on your record and all the life-destroying consequences that come with a felony record. But you're going to do a heavy sentence for that misdemeanor in exchange, right? Because we're letting you plead to something less. And in Urich's case, from what I can see, the initial charges were pretty serious, and he was found not guilty because of evidentiary reasons. So, you know, that probably gave the state an incentive to seek the max for those misdemeanor sentences because of what it could have been. But, you know, that's not how the law works, or that's not how it's supposed to work.
Judge Durkin called it one of the most challenging cases he's ever presided over. He said he's certain that some may say Joe was given preferential treatment because he's a doctor. Quote, "Quite frankly, if you have the opportunity to save even one life while on community control as a result of this sentence, I believe that to be justice." The State Medical Board of Ohio suspended Joe's medical license for 1 year due to the conviction. It was reinstated in February 2020. A wrongful death lawsuit against him by Brian Cuppett's estate has since been settled. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you agree with the verdict? Do you think justice was served in this case? Or do you think more should have been done? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. A special thank you to Karen Koble for talking to me about this episode. You can check out her website at ToledoLegalResource.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.